Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. We're currently working our way through the book of Revelation in our study of eschatology. Visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org. Now let's join our teacher, Jim McLarty.
First off, this week we received emails from a fellow in Poland. That's a first for us. Who has been reading on the site and learning Reformed theology. He comes out of the Catholic and Eastern Byzantine churches and has come to understand Reformed theology and wants more stuff, more information, and asked if we could send him any books or information. So I'm going to send him several things. So that's kind of exciting. And then a pastor in Belize down in South America asking for information and had been reading on the site and stuff. So I said, okay. And then the folks up in Canada have gotten in touch with me, so that's kind of cool. So little church in Smyrna continues to reach all these people. And I always say the same thing. If they write and say, can we have some discs? Can we have some CDs with teaching on it? The answer is always yes. You know, it's like, yeah, sure, I'll send you that stuff. But to know that we're hitting areas as diverse as Poland and India and South America and Canada and England, and I mean, it's just really remarkable. No one, however, has written to me so far from the Vatican. And I, you know, I'm waiting. I check every day. I'm hoping to convert anybody, especially the guy with the big white hat. You know, I'm hoping one day he'll write to me and go, I see what you're saying. By golly. But so far, nothing. Let's take up, because I've kind of skated around the question the last few weeks, let's take up the question of Peter in Rome, because it does actually play into what we're reading in Revelation 17. The significance of Peter in Rome is this. Catholic tradition claims that Peter was the first pope, and that when Jesus said, I give you the keys to the kingdom, they believe that it was Peter who received those keys in some vague fashion. There are a lot of questions surrounding that. Turn to Matthew 15 or Matthew 16, starting around verse 18. Well, you really need to start before that. Say 16, 16. Say 16, 15. Everybody there? Okay, then I'm going to start at Matthew 16, 13. When Jesus came into the coast of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, saying, whom do men say that I, the Son of Man, am? And they said, some say that you are John the Baptist, some say Elias, others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. And he said, but who do you say that I am? Simon Peter answered and said, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus answered and said unto him, blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed this unto you, but my Father which is in heaven. And I say unto you that you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. And I will give unto thee the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatsoever you shall bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatsoever you shall loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. Then he charged the disciples that they should tell no man that he was Jesus the Christ. So the Catholics make a great deal of that little passage, and they say that there are several important things happening there. When Jesus says, you are Peter, and then he says, and on this rock, they point out that the name Peter, Petros, means rock, when in fact it's a diminutive form of rock. And there's actually two different words going on in that one sentence. Yes? Yes. If Jesus meant to equate Peter and the rock, he would have used the same word, but he actually changed from a feminine to a masculine.
Okay,
go ahead. One is nominative and one is?
One is in the dative, it looks like to me.
In the dative?
Or it could be feminine genitive, but it's not the same case.
Right, exactly. So they're not in the same case. One is feminine, one is masculine. That was the point I was getting at. And so in the Greek language, had he been talking about the same thing in both instances, had Peter the human been the rock upon which he was saying he would build his church, he would not have changed the case in the middle of the sentence.
Gender, I'm sorry.
Gender is the word I was looking
for.
He could
have changed the case depending on its usage in the sentence, but yes, it's right. Gender, he wouldn't have changed.
Exactly. And he did change it there, did he not? Yeah. So in this instance, when he says, "Who do men say that I am?" and Peter says, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God," and he says, "Blessed are you, Simon Peter, blessed are you, Peter, because flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father has revealed this to you, and on this rock," and the rock must be a different thing than Peter the person, then it must be the declaration that Jesus is the Christ, that is the founding rock on which he's going to build the church. Make sense? Mm-hmm. And so, still okay, Jeff? Mm-hmm. Okay. So the Catholic Church will take that notion of Peter being the rock, even though it's not grammatically correct. They'll take the notion of Peter being the rock to say that Jesus built the church on Peter. And that's where you get all the emphasis on the succession of popes and being able to trace the papacy back to Peter himself. Because if Peter is the one who received the keys to the kingdom, which gives him the ability to bind things on earth that are bound in heaven or to loose things on earth that are loosed on heaven, then they say that that gives him God-given papal authority to decide what he wants to bind and what he wants to loose, particularly when you're talking about a person's sins, that Peter would then have the capability to bind a person's sins and hold that person in their sinfulness so that they could rightly be judged, or to loose them of their sinfulness and forgive their sins, and then they would be loosed. Now, again, I'm going to lean on you for a second, Jeff, because that binding and loosing is in the tense that would more rightly be translated, whatever you shall bind on earth is that which is already bound in heaven, correct?
Yes.
That's the way that Wiest translates it.
I'll put him way over me.
Okay. And the point that he makes is that it's not that there is the freedom in Peter's case, to bind and loose whatever he wants, and then heaven reacts to it, but rather that by the Spirit, whoever has these keys of the kingdom, which are actually being given to the apostles, not to Peter individually, is that the things that they bind and loose, the things that they would allow or bind on earth, would be those things that heaven has already bound or loosed. They are simply the outward demonstration of those things. So, my point in bringing any of that up is that the Catholic interpretation of that passage is dependent on things that are still actually up for debate, things that are still not defensible within the text, and things that you have to be willing to say, well, the teaching magisterium of the church says this is what it means, therefore I have to accept that this is what it means, even if the language in the Greek doesn't support what they say it means. And it all goes back to trying to make Peter the first pope. Well, if Peter is the first pope, and if that papacy is founded in Rome and was meant to be founded in Rome and continued on forward throughout all of the leaders of the church at Rome, if the bishop at Rome, the phrase that is still used for the pope, if bishop at Rome is synonymous with pope, then Peter would have to have been the bishop at Rome at some point in order for the papacy to have continued from Rome. Does that all make sense? The problem is, of course, that there's very little historicity to the idea that Peter was ever at Rome. And Peter does write that he's in Babylon. And he may, in fact, have been writing from Babylon, as we read last week from Fred Zaspel. He says, yes, but there really wasn't a Babylon at the time as a historic city, nor is there any history of there being a Mesopotamian church of any significance that Peter would have been visiting, none of which precludes the notion that Peter could have, in fact, been writing from Mesopotamia. That could have been where he was at the moment that he stopped and wrote. So that debate, where was Peter, and did Peter ever get to Rome, that debate continues to rage. The reason I bring it up is that Catholic apologists, in order to explain Peter's absence from Rome and the fact that Peter not being at Rome couldn't have really been the first bishop of Rome and therefore not technically the first pope, in their explanations, even Catholic explanations of Peter's emergent papacy, they can't help but combine Rome and Babylon. And they do it all the time. And that's my point, is that Rome and Babylon are inextricably tied together. The concept of Babylon and the city of Rome continue to be tied together. And we're going to see it again tonight if we get to it, where it's going to be said that the woman is riding on a beast that has seven heads, and these seven heads are seven hills on which the woman sits. I took this quote straight from the Catholic Encyclopedia. The Catholic Encyclopedia itself states, and I quote, "It is within the city of Rome, called the City of Seven Hills, that the entire area of the Vatican State proper is now confined." The whole of the Vatican is contained within the city on seven hills. And then you get to the book of Revelation, and it says that the woman sits on seven hills. These kind of connections become so unavoidable that they confirm it without really knowing what it is they're confirming. In that case, they were just confirming that, yes, the whole Vatican City is within Rome, within the seven hills that define and confine Rome. But they're also validating exactly what John said about where the woman would sit in the last days. Follow all that? So let me read for you now from Catholic Answers. Catholic Answers is one of my favorite Catholic apologetic websites, where the question came up, was Peter in Rome? I'm going to go ahead and read the whole argument, because that way you'll understand how they approach the argument of Peter being in Rome or not. But then you'll see what the only answer is that they can offer. And the only thing they can offer is Rome is Babylon. And that's quite an astounding admission when you get into chapter 17 and 18 of the book of Revelation and all of God's absolute detestation of Babylon. And yet, even the Catholics end up saying, Rome is Babylon. And here it is on Catholic Answers. Like other Protestants, fundamentalists say, Christ never appointed Peter as the earthly head for the simple reason that the church has no earthly head and was never meant to have one. Christ is the church's only foundation in any possible sense of that term. Notice first off that he's disagreeing with the notion that Christ is the sufficient head of the church. And certainly Paul has stated that enough times that it's undeniable. In every speaking of the church, he always says, and it has Christ as the head. But right away, he starts out with the pejorative answer that, like other Protestants, fundamentalists, that'd be people like me, fundamentalists, I guess, people who are trying to put the mental back in fundamentalism, fundamentalists, say that Christ never appointed Peter as the earthly head. Well, I agree with that. Christ never appointed Peter as the earthly head, primarily because, as we just looked at the text, it can't be supported from there. But the papacy, they say, arose out of 5th or 6th century politics, both secular and ecclesiastical. It has no connection with the New Testament. Can you find the papacy anywhere in the New Testament? No. So then does it have any connection with the New Testament? No. If we're going to start saying that it doesn't have to actually be stated in the New Testament to be connected with the New Testament, then really the door is flung wide open. Because I can think of a lot of things the New Testament doesn't talk about that I can claim are connected with the New Testament if I just feel like making stuff up. And the papacy did, in fact, from a historical standpoint, the earliest political leaders, emperors of Rome, who also wanted to be the head of the church, is the early construction of the papacy. You simply don't find the word pope or papacy appearing anywhere for the first four centuries of the church's existence. It simply doesn't exist. And in the earliest church councils, the bishop at Rome has no greater authority than the bishop that appears from Antioch or Egypt or Africa, anywhere else. When there are early councils of the church, the bishop of Rome, in fact, sometimes doesn't even appear. He sends emissaries to speak on his behalf. And you can find plenty of early church documents where other bishops take deference to what the bishop of Rome says and actually argue against him and vote him down. So the notion that the bishop at Rome is a successor of Peter and has Peter's authority and has the keys of the kingdom and can do the binding and loosing, and every other bishop and head of the church has to do obeisance to the will of the bishop at Rome, who speaks infallibly for God, that concept doesn't exist. And in fact, even the notion of papal infallibility is only 100 years old, 150 now. So those concepts are brand new developmental concepts that are unknown to the first several hundred years of the church. The papacy, they say, arose out of 5th or 6th century politics, both secular and ecclesiastical, and has no connection with the New Testament. It has not been established by Christ. Do you find anywhere where Christ established the papacy in the New Testament?
No,
it simply isn't there. Even those supposed successors to Peter and their defenders claim that it was. The successors claim to be successors of Peter. Of course they claim that it was.
Whose point of view are you reading from right now? Not Catholic Answers,
are you? This is a Catholic Answers writing. Yeah. They're saying what the standard Protestant objections are so that they can answer the objections. They're telling us what these objections standardly are. At best, they say, the papacy is a ruse, at worst, a work of evil. In any case, it is an institution designed to give the Catholic Church an authority that it doesn't have. That's what a Protestant would claim. Remember, we start out, like other Protestant fundamentalists say, well, these are all the sort of things that Protestant fundamentalists like myself would say. A key premise of their argument is the assertion that Peter was never in Rome, and that's why this is interesting to us. It follows that if Peter were never in Rome, he could not have been Rome's first bishop, and so could not have had any successors in that office. How can Catholics talk about the divine origin of the papacy, fundamentalists argue, when their claim about Peter's whereabouts is wrong? Let's look at this last charge, reserving for another tract, a look at Peter's position among the apostles in the early church, and they will claim that Peter had supremacy within the early church, a supremacy over the other apostles based on the fact that he supposedly got these keys that Jesus said he was going to have, and he was the rock on which the church was built and the gates of hell would not prevail against it. That's the standard argument about Peter's supremacy over the other apostles and then the successors of Peter having similar supremacy. Yes, which does make you kind of go, yeah, but yeah, that little thing in Antioch where Paul had to withstand Peter to his face because he was to be blamed. Yeah, if he was in fact the Pope, he wouldn't have been blamable, would he? But don't let the Bible get in the way, Jeff. That's only going to confuse you. If you let the Bible dictate your thinking about Christianity, there's no place for the Roman tradition to get in there and tell you. How to understand the argument? At first glance, it might seem that the question of whether Peter was in Rome and died there is inconsequential. So first he's going to say, well, it doesn't really matter if Peter was there or not. He still could have been the first pope, and then when he came to Rome, he brought the papacy with him. That's going to be the argument. And in a way it is. After all, Peter's being in Rome would not itself prove the existence of the papacy. In fact, it would be a false inference to say that he must have been the first pope since he was in Rome and later popes ruled from Rome. With that logic, Paul would have been the first pope too since he was an apostle and he went to Rome. I agree with that argument, but he's going to now do an end run around that argument. On the other hand, if Peter never made it to the capital, he still could have been the first pope, since one of his successors could have been the first holder of the office to settle in Rome. So he's claiming if Peter was in fact made the first pope, he wouldn't have had to have been in Rome, that the successor that Peter designated could have then gone to Rome and would have continued being the first pope, and you'd still have an unbroken succession back to Peter. Now, you have no history for this.
I was going to say no record.
Right.
No.
No direct correlation historically.
I wasn't first.
You could have been. We don't know. After all, if the papacy exists, it was established by Christ during his lifetime, long before Peter is said to have reached Rome. After all, if the papacy exists, it was established by Christ in his lifetime. Not necessarily. The papacy, quote unquote, does exist, and it was not established by Christ during his lifetime. It is a construction of political and ecclesiastical power during the 5th and 6th century, but in any case. There must have been a period of some years in which the papacy did not yet have its connection to Rome. So if the apostle got there only much later, that might have something to say about who his legitimate successors would be, and it does, since the man elected Bishop of Rome is automatically the new pope, on the notion that Peter was the first Bishop of Rome and the pope is merely Peter's successor. But it would say nothing about the status of the papal office. It would not establish that the papacy was initiated by Christ in the first place. No, somehow the question, while interesting historically, doesn't seem to be crucial to the real issue whether the papacy was founded by Christ. Still, most anti-Catholic organizations take up the matter and go to considerable trouble to prove, quote-unquote, that Peter could not have been in Rome. Why? Because they think that they can get mileage out of it. Quote, here's a point on which we can point to the lies of Catholic claims, they say. Catholics trace the papacy to Peter, and they say he was martyred in Rome after heading the church there. If we could show that he never went to Rome, that would undermine, psychologically if not logically, their assertion that Peter was the first pope. If people conclude that the Catholic Church was wrong on this historical point, they'll conclude it's wrong on the larger one, which is the supposed existence of the papacy, unquote, and such is the reasoning of leading anti-Catholics. Okay, so he's setting us up. He's trying to admit that I know what the argument is. I get all the arguments. Here's the arguments. Now he's going to solve all the arguments by making Babylon Rome. The charges in brief. The case is stated perhaps most succinctly, even if not so bluntly, by Lorraine Bettner in his best-known book, Roman Catholicism. Bettner is the one who wrote The Reformed Doctrine of Predestination, big old thick tome that was actually one of the books that turned my thinking around. In his book, page 117, he writes, "The remarkable thing, however, about Peter's alleged bishopric in Rome is that the New Testament does not say a word about it. The word Rome occurs only 9 times in the Bible, and then in parentheses, actually 10 times in the Old Testament and 10 times in the New. And never is Peter mentioned in connection with it. There is no allusion to Rome in either of his epistles. Paul's journey to this city is recorded in great detail in Acts 27 and 28. And there is, in fact, no New Testament evidence, nor any historical proof of any kind that Peter was ever in Rome. It all rests on legend," end quote. That's what Lorraine Bettner wrote. "Well, what about it?" says this writer from Catholic Answers. "Admittedly, the Bible nowhere explicitly says that Peter was in Rome. But, on the other hand, it doesn't say that he wasn't." So now you see where the logic is going, right? The Bible doesn't explicitly say he was in Rome. Hey, but it doesn't say he wasn't. And now, if we're going to use that logic, how many things can we introduce?
This is what Jesus said about North America with the Indians.
Yeah, it doesn't say Jesus came to North America, but it also doesn't not say it. So he might have been here, and the Mormons are right. It doesn't say that Mary was bodily assumed up into heaven, but it also doesn't say she wasn't. Doesn't say pray to Mary, but it also doesn't say don't. See the logic? Just as the New Testament never says, quote, Peter then went to Rome, it never says, quote, Peter did not go to Rome. In fact, very little is said about where he or any of the other apostles, other than Paul, went in the years after the ascension. For the most part, we have to rely on books other than the New Testament for information about what happened to the apostles, Peter included, in the later years. Bettner is wrong to dismiss these early historical documents as conveyors of mere legend. They are genuine historical evidence, as every professional historian recognizes. The next heading says, "What the Bible Says." Bettner is also wrong when he claims, quote, "there is no allusion to Rome in either of Peter's epistles." Now, Bettner was well aware when he wrote that sentence. He was well aware that the Catholics would like to connect Peter's reference to saying that he is in Babylon. The Catholics have long claimed that that was a coded reference to Rome, which is why Bettner said specifically that there is no allusion to Rome in either of Peter's epistles. But of course, the Catholic Answer guy wants to say he's wrong when he says that. There is, in the greeting at the end of the first epistle, quote, "the church here in Babylon, united with you by God's election, sends you her greeting, and so does my son Mark," 1 Peter 5:13. Babylon is a code word for Rome. That's what it says. I'm reading from Catholic Answers. Babylon is a code word for Rome. Now, of course, he trusts that his readers pay no attention to the book of Revelation. I have a Catholic Bible at home that says that the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation are a form of apocalyptic literature written for the time then present, but that we've lost the sense of how to properly interpret it, and therefore it's not important. Basically, don't read it. So if you can get people to not read all of Revelation 17 and 18, then you can say Babylon is a code word for Rome. You'll also notice that nowhere in the New Testament do you get any hint that Babylon is a code word for Rome. But they need it to connect Peter to Rome.
Well, that also brings up the idea, why would they let Revelation in the Bible in the first place? Why not hedge your bet, not even put it there?
That was my next question. Yeah. In the Catholic Bible, did they remove Revelations from there?
No, it's still in there. But
when the canon was initially put together, did they even consider the idea maybe they shouldn't be putting that stuff in?
Well, see, if you're getting into the question of the canon, that's the beginning of it. The canon was put together by early church councils that the Catholic Church will try to tell you were Catholic councils that were overseen by the Bishop of Rome. And therefore, when we as Protestants say that we don't believe in the teaching magisterium and tradition of the Catholic Church, but rather we argue as the Reformation, as the Reformers did, we argue sola scriptura, scripture alone, they say, well, you wouldn't even know what the scripture was if it wasn't for the Catholic Church defining what the canon was in the first place. Except that that assumes that the church that existed in the first 200 and 300 years of the church's existence that was responsible for assembling the canon is somehow equatable with the Catholic Church as it stands today. Those were early church councils in which Rome had no supremacy. The bishop at Rome had the same equality and power as bishops from other churches. But if you believe that the papacy is an unbroken line from the current pope all the way back to Peter, then they will argue that these were Roman church councils that were headed up by the bishop of Rome, and were it not for the Catholic Church, you wouldn't even know what the canon was. To answer your question, why is the book of Revelation even in there then? It's because when the canon was constructed, Rome did not have the kind of power it would take to keep it out. Right?
So,
Babylon is a code word for Rome. It is used that way multiple times in works like the Sibylline Oracles, the Apocalypse of Baruch, and 4th Esdras. Eusebius Pamphilius, in the Chronicle composed about AD 303, noted that, quote, it is said that Peter's first epistle, in which he makes mention of Mark, was composed at Rome itself, and that he himself indicates this, referring to the city figuratively as Babylon. Now let's see, AD 303... what was going on in the church world right around that period that would have helped us to have this kind of interpretation? The first time that you start to see the Bible being interpreted allegorically is in the early 300s. The same time that you see this kind of writing where they're looking for allegorical interpretation of certain things. And so, of course, for the first 300 years of the church's existence, everybody assumes Babylon is Babylon. Then as allegorical and Gnostic approaches to scripture start to develop, you find Eusebius Pamphilius in the Chronicle, composed in AD 303, saying that even though Peter wrote that he was in Babylon, that it was figuratively Babylon, but it really meant Rome. But you don't see anybody who was contemporary with Peter, or anybody in the first couple hundred of years who would have known directly of Peter, you don't see anybody writing that. It takes a few hundred years for that to develop. And even though 303 AD sounds early to us, how long has America been a nation?
Yeah.
200 years, a little better? How many changes has America gone through from being established as a nation where they said to hold public office you have to be a Christian, to the Ninth Circuit Court saying you can't say the Pledge of Allegiance because it has the word God in it? Now, how much historic development has occurred in 200 years here? Okay, so you've got 300 years here before you've got the first mention that when Peter says Babylon, he might have meant Rome. But more importantly, one citation from one guy writing allegorically 300 years later, just because it's old doesn't make it true. That would be like Tom writing, you know, getting a piece of paper and writing a joke where he said, in year 2005, everyone on Earth turned purple. And then he loses that piece of paper and ends up in a dump somewhere. And, you know, 300, 400, 500, 600 years from now, somehow that piece of paper shows up. And people start quoting, well, Tom Tharp said 600 years ago that in 2005 all humans turned purple. So they start looking for evidence of the purple people that inhabited the planet. Age does not mean correctness. Do you get what I'm saying? Antiquity does not mean rightness. It only means old. So again, unless it can be held to some objective standard, which any reformer would argue is the Bible, unless it could be held to an objective standard, how early on did Paul have to write to the church at Galatia and say, who has already bewitched you? How soon? How quickly? Why are you removed from the gospel that's already been taught to you? That's in Paul's lifetime. We're talking a matter of years before the gospel was, to use Paul's words, perverted by the others who came in and were already trying to change what he had taught. 300 years? There's plenty of time there for the earlier generations who would have actually had firsthand knowledge to die away, and then for things like conjecture and legend and different forms of interpretation to develop. So the fact that you can find somebody 300 years after the fact saying that this is where Peter was and this is what Peter meant, just because it's old doesn't prove it was true. You understand that? Now, notice also, by the way, that in order to get the notion that Babylon is a code word for Rome, where did he go? He went to the Sibylline oracles to prove the historic validity of the papacy. We're going to the Sibylline oracles or the Apocalypse of Baruch. Let's use that to demonstrate the validity of the papacy. I mean, if that's where you got to go for your evidence, pretty shaky evidence. Consider now the other New Testament citations. Okay, he's now going to quote Revelation 14:8. Now, this is astounding to me that he would quote Revelation in his defense. Consider now the other New Testament citations. Quote, another angel, a second, followed, saying, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, she who made all nations drink the wine of her impure passion. Revelation 14:8. And then, quote, the great city was split into three parts, and the cities of the nation fell, and God remembered great Babylon to make her drain the cup of his fury, of his wrath. Revelation 16:19. Quote, and on her forehead was written the name of mystery, Babylon the Great, mother of harlots and of the earth's abominations. That's Revelation 17:5. Quote, and he called out with a mighty voice, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. Revelation 18:2. Quote, they will stand afar in fear of her torment, and they will say, alas, alas, thou great city, thou mighty city Babylon, in 1 hour has thy judgment come. Revelation 18:10. And quote, so shall Babylon, the great city, be thrown down with violence. Revelation 18:21. These references cannot be to the one-time capital of the Babylonian Empire. That Babylon has been reduced to an inconsequential village by the march of years, military defeat, and political subjugation. It was no longer a, quote, great city. It played no important part in the recent history of the ancient world. From the New Testament perspective, the only candidates for the great city mentioned in Revelation are Rome and Jerusalem. In his defense of the papacy, and in order to connect Peter to Rome, he just said that all of those condemnations by God of Babylon in Revelation are referring to Rome. And that's Catholic Answers. I pulled it off their website. Because it's inescapable that Revelation 17 and 18 is connecting Babylon and Rome.
Do they think that their followers will not read that? I mean,
I gotta be honest with you. I read this and just kind of went, what you guys all made a face at me like, what? Yeah, I mean, I don't know what he thinks his followers are following. More likely, what's probably the case, is that most of these Catholics are not even amillennialists. I mean, they really are, if panmillennialism exists. If anything, they believe that all of this is history. Remember that I said it's apocalyptic literature. It all had to do with the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. It's all past, therefore it can't touch us. And so those references of Babylon being Rome itself back then and whatever happened back then isn't integral to what's going on in Rome right now in the papacy, because it's ancient history and we can't really understand it anyway. The point he's trying to make is that Babylon and all the references to Babylon in the book of Revelation, since Babylon is an ancient city, couldn't have been standing at the time, that all these references to Babylon as a great city had to be to Rome. Therefore, when Peter said Babylon, he meant Rome, and that puts Peter in Rome, and that's his point.
He's got such blinders on, he doesn't see the implication of what he just said.
Yeah, exactly.
He doesn't see the implications of what he just said.
As a Catholic apologist, he's encountered people saying Rome is Babylon in Revelation, and the papacy is Antichrist.
Mm-hmm. Sure he has.
So I'm stunned. That
I know. Talk about playing right into the opposition's hands. Okay, so then, these references cannot be to the one-time capital of the Babylonian Empire. From the New Testament perspective, the only candidates for the great city mentioned in Revelation are Rome and Jerusalem. But there is no good reason for saying that Babylon means Rome, insists Lorraine Bettner, but there is. And the good reason is persecution. Okay, now he's going to explain what those passages apparently meant, and notice how closely he's going to parallel all the stuff we've been hearing from Hank Hanegraaff. Now you're going to see Hank connect with Rome and Rome's description of what the tribulation must have been as being history past and the persecution that happened in Rome. But there is. The good reason is persecution. The authorities knew that Peter was a leader of the church. Now that's conjecture, of course, but the authorities knew that Peter was a leader of the church, and the church, under Roman law, was considered organized atheism. The worship of any gods other than the Roman were considered, or was considered, atheism. Peter would do himself, not to mention those with him, no service by advertising that he was present in the capital. After all, mail service from Rome was even then worse than it is today. Ha, ha, ha. And letters were routinely read by Roman officials. Peter was a wanted man, as were all Christian leaders, so why encourage a manhunt? We also know that the apostles sometimes referred to cities under symbolic names, and of course he references Revelation 11:8 to prove that point. So what he's claiming here is that because of the level of persecution that was going on in Rome, that even though Peter was in Rome, wherever he was writing that letter from, he feared that the Roman officials would read it and know that he was in Rome and come get him and kill him and persecute him. So he had to write that he was in Babylon to throw them off the track. Of course, it's amazing then that he would even identify himself as Peter, the apostle of the Lord. Doesn't it seem like he would have used a code name to those people on the other side, the same people who could figure out that Babylon means Rome? They would know that, you know, Bob means Peter. They'd be able to figure that out. So his argument is, I mean, that's the argument. There's the base of your argument, that Peter had to kind of keep it hidden where he was, and so he used a code name of Babylon because letters were routinely read by Roman officials and Peter was a wanted man, as were all Christian leaders. So in order to avoid persecution. Now, by the way, let's think about that too for a moment, though. Peter, supposedly the first pope. You've got Paul, who said that all of the suffering and the persecution he underwent for how publicly he declared Christ, stonings, beatings, shipwrecks, prison, because of how public he was about his proclamation of Christ, right? On Mars Hill, arguing with the philosophers. Jesus said, you're going to witness of me all the way up to the emperor. I mean, he was in Rome testifying in court, standing before Felix the governor, testifying of Christ, going in front of the kings, testifying of Christ. But Peter, the first pope, hiding, saving his own skin, wouldn't admit where he was because he was fearful of the persecution that apparently Paul was bravely walking into.
And talking in code.
And talking in code to keep himself safe and save his own little hide, rather than openly speak the way Paul did. So then really, who should be the first pope? Paul should. Under what circumstances could you say that Peter was Peter who has the keys here, Peter who can bind things on earth and loose things on earth, is hiding in a corner somewhere saying, this is Bob and I'm in Babylon? What? It makes no logical sense. This is Peter, by the way, who stood up on the day of Pentecost and at the risk of his own life declared to the leaders of the Jews, you have killed the Prince of Life. That's quite bold.
Yep.
And then they put him in prison, and what happened? An angel of the Lord came, earthquake, opened the prison. Hey, Peter. Peter's standing outside the door, knocking at the door while they're inside praying for Peter's release. They came and said, hey, Peter's at the door. And they said, no, no, he's in prison. God has released him. So what evidence do we have that Peter should be fearful? Or that he ever was fearful? Or that he would hide himself or cloak himself? Rather, what you see on the day of Pentecost is just this open proclamation of who Christ was, because he had all this confidence that the risen Lord was sufficient to protect him. But the Catholics would have you believe that he would write in code to protect himself because he was fearful that the authorities would read his mail. It's a pretty bad argument. It's also not a very biblical argument. In any event, let us be generous and admit that it is easy for an opponent of Catholicism to think, in good faith, that Peter was never in Rome, at least if he bases his conclusions on the Bible alone. Where else would you want to base your conclusions? Come on. But restricting his inquiry to the Bible is something he should not do. External evidence has to be considered, too. And what he gave us as external evidence was conjecture about Peter writing under code words based on the Sibylline oracles. Whoa. Now, my point in bringing all that up is that even on Catholic Answers, you end up with this connection where in chapter 17 of Revelation, these references to Babylon, since at the time that John was on the Isle of Patmos, Babylon as a city didn't stand. Therefore, the argument is that God is not talking about Babylon the city. He's talking about Babylon the religious structure, the history of tradition, the mystery religion, and that it is centered in a different place. And he's going to identify that different place as being seven hills. And those seven hills lead us back to Rome. It's just kind of inescapable to me. So that really takes us to chapter 17, verse 7. Starting at verse 1, there came one of the seven angels that had the seven vials, and he talked to me, saying, come here, and I'll show you the judgment of the great whore that sits upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast, full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color, and she was decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints, and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus, and when I saw her, I wondered with great, the King James says great admiration, which is a strange translation. It's great wonderment, bewilderment,
amazement.
And you can see why he would be amazed. Now remember that Jesus has died, Jesus has left, the church is still small, the church is being driven, persecuted, John's on an island, he sees an angel who shows him a representation of a world religion that sits on every nation, that has influence over all people, that looks like a Christian replacement, anti-Christian church, and this woman has not only worldwide influence, but that she's a harlot and she's riding on this seven-headed beast. She has this golden cup in her hand full of abomination and the blood of the saints. It's no wonder that he marveled. He had to wonder how it was going to go from this little persecuted Middle Eastern sect of Christian believers to a world-dominant anti-Christian religion that would come out of Babylon and be carried somehow on the back of a purportedly Christian church. It's no wonder that he was amazed. And the angel said to me, wherefore do you marvel? I'll tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her that has the seven heads and the ten horns. Terrific. This is going to be great. He's going to do the interpreting. We don't have to do it. The beast that you saw was, is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit. Is that familiar to us now? Okay, we've referenced this before. We came at it from Daniel. We came at it from early in the book of Revelation. Yeah, we came at it when Jesus said, write the things that you've seen, the things that are, and the things that will be. So what we're talking about here is a demonic influence a devil, a demon, a beast. It is not. What does that mean? He is not.
Not currently alive.
Not currently alive. Isn't during the time that John is writing. During the time of Rome, he is not. Now again, this is very important. I know I've made a great deal of Hake Hanegraaff's apparently very Catholic interpretation of the tribulation and the notion that the persecution during Nero is the fulfillment of the tribulation. The problem is, according to the Bible, the beast that is alive during the tribulation wasn't alive during John's time. Again, another great big hole in Hank's thinking. The beast that you saw was, okay, what is was from John's perspective? Before John. Is not, as John is writing this, and shall future ascend out of the bottomless pit. So he's coming out of the abyss to take power somewhere future from John. John's writing this somewhere 92, 96 AD, or at very least that's the period when he was on Patmos. He may have written it even after that, but somewhere in the area of 100 AD, the turn of the century forward, there's going to be a beast rise up out of the pit. But it can't be during John's time. And that takes the whole Roman persecution and throws it out the window in terms of being a fulfillment of the tribulation. The beast that you saw was, is not, shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world. There's another astounding statement. Here John mentions that there is a book of life that was written before the foundation of the world. And then he says the people who will wonder at this beast when it appears will be people who are still on the earth. Now, if you believe that the book of Revelation is chronological, and I do, by the time you get to chapter 17, you've already been through the seals, you've already been through the trumpets, you've already been through the bowls, you've been through all these judgments, you've already reached the point where God has said, it is finished. All of that has occurred, and then he turns his attention to Babylon, which is represented as this beast, and the people who wonder at the beast, which I can only assume are the people who would take the mark of the beast, it is called the mark of the beast, and all of those people end up in the lake of fire under God's judgment because they took the mark of the beast and because they worshiped the Antichrist and followed after the false prophet. Well, then I can only assume that all these people who wonder after the beast who are on the earth, that John's point is they're on the earth wondering because their name was not written in the Lamb's Book of Life from before the foundation of the world. Which is very selective. Which sounds very much like God chose some people. He elected. He wrote down some names. And if your name isn't in the book, he's going to leave you on the planet when the beast is there. And he will, remember we read it out of 2 Thessalonians, he will turn them over to a strong delusion and they will believe the lie and they will be damned. That's all this group. So you've clearly got two groups. You've got the written in the Lamb's Book of Life group and you've got the not written group. The not written group is here wandering after the beast, takes the mark, ends up in the lake of fire. And you've got the written group who there's nothing said about except, apparently, not on the earth. Because everybody on the earth is identified as not written in the book. So where are the people who are written in the book? Not on earth. The beast that you saw was, is not, shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition, and they that dwell on the earth shall wonder. Can the church wonder in amazement after the beast? No, we can't. I mean, we couldn't theologically, right? We couldn't religiously. We couldn't spiritually. If we have the Holy Spirit in us, could we possibly long after and wonder and take the mark of the beast? Clearly not. But they that dwell on the earth will, which leads me to conclude that they're not here. Or should I say, we're not here. We're not here. I'll personalize. Those that are written in the book can't be on the earth at that point. But those who are on the earth, all they that dwell on the earth shall wonder whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world. Really think about the implications of that. Because, I just got done reading John R. Rice's book, Predestined to Hell? No. But if you only get to go to heaven if your name is written in the book, and God doesn't write your name in the book, and then he turns you over to a strong delusion so you'll believe the lie and be damned, it sounds like God's predestinary will is playing out in every instance. That the sovereignty of God is big enough to save who he will, and those that he doesn't save are condemned because that's the way God did it. And of course, there's not going to be anybody who's going to be able to stand before the throne of God, shake their fist, and argue that it's not fair. They shall wonder whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is future. So, during John's time, whatever the demonic influence is that's going to take up residence in the beast, the little horn, who's just called the little horn, which is a symbol of power, who is more stout than his fellows, according to Daniel, he is just a political leader until he is overtaken by this spirit, and then he becomes the beast. Now, in a moment, when these heads are delineated, he's going to say that the seven heads are seven kingdoms that have seven kings, and then he's going to introduce the beast and say he is the eighth, but he is of the seven, introducing the notion that these are seven kingdoms and seven kings over these kingdoms, but then there is the beast power, this demonic power that then takes up residence in the seventh of these horns, the seventh of these heads, the seventh of these kings, and then he becomes known as the beast because he is in fact inhabited by the beast that came out of the bottomless pit. And here is the mind that has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. And I started out tonight by reading to you from the Catholic Encyclopedia that states, it is within the city of Rome, called the City of Seven Hills, that the entire area of the Vatican State proper is now confined. There's nowhere else on earth where you can find a major city that's geographically identified as sitting on seven hills. But here, the mind that has wisdom will recognize that these seven heads on which this woman is riding, that are part of this beast, are seven mountains on which the woman sits. Find me another place. Are there other choices?
So basically, is this saying that the Antichrist is going to be the Pope?
No. He's going to rise up out of the Seleucid portion of the ancient Alexandrian Empire. But I think when you talk false prophet, religious leader, then I think it's going to be kind of hard to not connect the papacy in some way. Yeah. And by saying that, I'm not saying anything that the reformers haven't said ever since 1600s. I mean, they have always pointed at Rome and said, the seat of Antichrist is right over there. And of course, Rome bristles at that and then madly interprets Revelation to push it back into history in order to say, well, that's not anything we have to worry about in the future. That's already done. It's already back there. And then, of course, Hank helps them with that. You know. But now, just so it's clear here, verse 9 and 10 combined, verse 9 says, here is the mind that has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. And, he interprets it a second way, and verse 10, there are seven kings. Five are fallen. One is, during John's time, and the other is not yet come. This is very, very helpful. Who are the five kingdoms that have already fallen? Well, we know from Daniel's prophecies, when he saw the figure of the statue with the golden head and the silver breastplate and arms and the belly of bronze and the legs of iron and the 10 toes of iron and clay, it's very clear from that figure forward that you've got Babylon and you've got Medo-Persia and you've got Greece and you've got Rome. So then what kingdoms persecuted Israel prior to Babylon? That takes you back to Assyria and Egypt. And if you start at Egypt and do Egypt and Assyria and then Babylon and Medo-Persia and then Greece and then Rome, you have exactly six kingdoms that have ever historically subjugated God's people Israel. And so it fits perfectly when he says that there are seven kings, five have fallen. That's right. Five of those ancient kingdoms were gone. So one is, clearly when he's writing this, Rome is the one that is, because he's been sent to the island by Domitian, the Roman emperor. So seven kings, five are fallen, one is, the other is not yet come. The seventh king, identified as the beast, has not yet appeared on the stage of history when John is writing this, 92, 96 AD, somewhere in that period. Which, again, if that's true, then Hank Hanegraaff is just all wet. He wants to make that succession of kings Roman emperors. But you can't say that five have fallen and one is yet to come and say the one that is to come that is the worst yet is Nero when Nero's dead before John's ever on Patmos. So the other is not yet come, and when he comes, he will continue a short space. We know that's true. We know that he has essentially a seven-year deal, but 3.5 years of actual powerful reign. Verse 11 says, and the beast that was and is not during John's time, even he is the eighth, and he's of the seven. And he goes into perdition. That's the exact same language up here where it says, the beast that you saw that was and is not shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. So we know now that when John was writing, we're going to stop there. I'm going to pick up at verse 12. I've already marked it. We'll get into the 10 horns next week. But as John was writing, the angel of the Lord told him that there was this woman sitting on a beast, and that woman on the beast held sway over all the people and nations and kings of the earth. She was a religious system. She's connected to Babylon. She has all this imagery that's connected to Semiramis and Ishtar and all these Babylonish Queen of Heaven type images. She's got a golden cup in her hand that's full of the abominations and of her fornications with the kings of the earth and the blood of all the saints. So it's really horrible, wicked imagery. And then the angel says, let me identify it for you. That beast represents seven kingdoms, and the seven kingdoms aren't hard to identify by reading your Old Testament, especially by letting Daniel identify them, and then recognizing the Exodus out of Egypt, and recognizing God bringing the Assyrians down. If you just look at the history of the Old Testament, it's really easy to identify what kingdoms those are. And any, by the way, any Israelite or Jew reading the book of Revelation, because I keep stressing what a Jewish book it is, are going to go, yeah, that's exactly right. Yes, there have been six kingdoms so far that have ever oppressed us, leading right up to the time of John. No confusion there at all about who those would be. And then he says there is this demonic power that is not during John's time, was prior to John's time, and will return out of the bottomless pit and will take that seventh king, become one with that seventh king, and then go into that perdition that he was predicted to go into. So we're talking about a human, a person, a political leader who's going to be demonically possessed in order to carry out the final war and cataclysm against God, so that God can then wipe up the planet, rightly judge everybody, 1,000-year reign of Christ on earth, and then new heaven, new earth. So that's all future. If you can find a historic personage that qualifies as being not alive during John's time, but alive after that, that has influence over the whole world, if you can find somebody, tell me. Because, again, the only candidate people toss out there is Nero, but the Bible doesn't allow for that. If you push further back, people attempt to say Antiochus Epiphanes, but he clearly predates all of this stuff. Who is it? And if you can't tell me who it is and connect all those dots, he hasn't been here yet. But he's coming, and I am convinced that we'll be gone, according to Paul, before he comes. That the restraining force that holds him back will restrain till it's taken out of the way, and then will that man of sin be revealed. And then Paul uses the same language. But then he goes into perdition. That's exactly what he's here to do. The son of perdition. I mean, but he says that that man won't be revealed until the restraining force is taken away, and that restraining force has to be the church, especially within the context, as Paul writes. So we won't be here to see it, but it's still coming, is the point. And Mystery Babylon is inextricably tied to Rome, geographically by the Seven Hills, but theologically and religiously by the fact that there is no other religious entity on the planet right now keeping Babylonish mystery religion alive to the extent that Rome is. It's just a simple reality. Anybody taking the time to go read any Hyslop this week to start seeing some of those connections? Or it's all there. Okay, any questions about all that? So it's nice that you know, John... Oh, by the way, I guess I got to say then. So then, if it's true that we're going to be gone when all this happens, who did John really write this for?
The Jews.
The remnant.
The remnant.
Has to be for the remnant, doesn't it? Would it be any help to the people who are blinded, who are following after the Antichrist? Is it any help to them?
No.
No. Is it any help to the church? No, we're gone. So it has to be written to the remnant. The remnant must exist, and that means that Israel continues to be the focus of God's word, even all the way out to Revelation. You simply can't Gentilize it. I've coined a new word. You can't Gentilize it and continue to make it make sense. It has to be written to the remnant of Israel that's still on the earth to assure them that they're going to be okay at the end of all of that. Right? So that when they see all that stuff happening, they'll be able to pick up John and read it and go, yep. They can just stand there and check the stuff off. Yep. Oh, there it goes. Yep. Knowing full well that then Christ is going to be back, which is why you can see why when he cracks the sky and comes back, that it says that Israel, the remnant of Israel, will weep as a mother weeps over her only child. They'll be so happy to see him back. Yeah, they'll be real happy to see him, and they won't have any problem accepting him for who he is.
Thank you for joining us for this week's study. We invite you back next week for another Salvation by Grace message.